So, this is the plan of my talk. Since I don't know exactly how central the topic of my talk is for this workshop, I've chosen to give a sort of review talk on the subject, emphasizing more the main ideas and results without going into the details of some of the calculations. But of course, I'm ready to answer more detailed questions. And this is my talk for its original part is based on works that I've done with Brignole and Ferruglio, mainly with occasional collaboration with Mangano and Perazzi in the last 2 years. So I think it's important to describe the motivations. Well, there are some physical scales whose numerical value we know. For example, the Planck scale associated with the Newton constant, something times 10 to the 18 GeV, and the scale of electroweak symmetry breaking associated with the Fermi constant of the order of 300 GeV. But there are other scales of theoretical physics for the moment whose numerical value we don't know. And after some relatively recent developments in string theories and related topics, we have realized that these scales may be smaller than what originally thought. For example, the string scale associated with the string coupling alpha prime could be in principle as small as the electroweak scale. Wait a second. Wait a second. I will comment on that. And the compactification scale, characterized by some radius r, without going into too many details, could be as small as the electroweak scale, or slightly more, if some of the standard model states have Kaluza-Klein excitations, or even as small as the weak scale square divided by the Planck scale if none of the standard model states has Kaluza-Klein excitations. Of course, and I'm coming also to your question, these statements are based more on some qualitative understanding from the fundamental theories and model-independent considerations more than from the construction of full, complete, realistic models.
Now,
for example, it was understood that the standard model states could be confined to a lower dimensional space than the space where the gravitational fields, that the fields with gravitational interactions live. And this led to the possibility of having compactification scale as small as this one, whereas previously this possibility wasn't. I didn't say that. I said that I'm using this as lower bounds. Okay? So, the point of my talk is that a similar question can be asked also for the supersymmetry breaking scale, that I will denote in my talk with lambda Susi and sometimes with square root of f when I will restrict myself to the case of f term supersymmetry breaking. And we shall see in a moment that the supersymmetry breaking scale is equivalent to the gravitino mass that I will denote with m3f, and this is the reason of the title of my talk. Now, for this talk, I will mostly discuss the case of four-dimensional n equal to 1 supersymmetry within the framework of quantum field theories. But of course, one could ask similar questions also for extended supersymmetries or for symmetry breaking mechanisms that cannot be described at the field theory level. Now, coming to your point, and I will come back to this again in my talk. Anytime you introduce a new scale close to the electroweak scale, not as large as the Planck scale or the grand unification scale, There is a number of problems that you have to face, in principle, associated with non-renormalizable operators constructed from standard model fields and suppressed only by inverse powers of this small scale. Now, it's obvious that all that at least some of the problems that are there and haven't been solved yet for these attempts of lowering some of the fundamental scales will be there in general also for any attempt to lower the supersymmetry breaking scaling. In particular, we lose the understanding, for example, of the supersymmetric unification of the gauge couplings within the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. On the other hand, the hope, which hasn't been fulfilled yet, but it's worth exploring, is that associating with the weak scale and the Planck scale some of the other fundamental scales of our theory, we may learn something about new possibilities for solving the hierarchy problems related with the electroweak scale versus the Planck scale, and also perhaps the cosmological constant scale. So after this introduction, I will start now with a review of supersymmetry breaking in four-dimensional field theories, where I don't want to offend you. So
why actually do you lose the unification?
Why is unification important? You know? Why is it something to worry about?
You don't have
multiple unification.
In this case, no, I know, but you are making myself say some things that I didn't say. There is a phenomenologically pleasant feature.
Okay. Because of this phenomenologic effect, that if I take the present values, run them, algorithmically they seem to meet.
Yes.
Why does this fact changes when you take L string to be one period? This fact still remains, isn't it?
Why? No, not necessarily. I mean, you have other states intervening, that modify.
It's not one very recent, some previous ones that claim that this is not the case, right?
No, for the moment, I think. First, the present day works are trying to see if there are possibilities in which you can have the running of the gauge couplings up to a fake, let's say, grand unification scale with the logarithmic evolution. So the present attempts, as far as I understand them, are focused on that instead of power-like corrections that would give you essentially no predictive power, because threshold effects are as big as the full correction you are computing. People are trying to see if there are situations in which you can still describe the running of couplings via logarithmic evolution. And there are examples, for example, the work of Kostaps, Bakas, and collaborators, and more recent works that have elaborated on that, in which this seems to be possible. But another story is to prove that that the coefficients of these logarithms are the same one-loop beta function coefficients of the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. In a sense, in the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, you build your particle content on the basis of another principle, the principle of constructing the minimal supersymmetric extension. You want supersymmetry to solve the hierarchy problem. Without extra assumptions, you get to a very good approximation this unification.
Do you understand correct that those things that are successful within this framework, it does unify within the system, is when you have a brain configuration, the running corresponds to the bending of the brains, and it's the most symmetric configuration of the brain, let's say all the distances between the brains are the same, that really to unification, and these are the frameworks where it does work. Unification, in the sense you mentioned, works within this
framework. Perhaps I prefer not to comment on this, but someone else may intervene in the discussion.
If this is, I think this is possibly a way to understand what these people claim. And this is correct, I say, that since this remedy is not natural, as the theory on some brain configuration, then it's most natural in this kind of doctrine of ethical approach. I'm not sure. I just wanted to learn.
Okay. So, I mean, it may well be that, I mean, this is just one experimental input, and it may well be that it's produced accidentally by the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. On the other hand, to abandon that accident, we would like to see at least some of the other problems solved in order to discard the standard picture of supersymmetric unification and by another one. For the moment, I'm not aware of any fundamental problem that has been solved by lowering some of these scales, but since this is a younger subject, one can still have hope.
Well, there is one
No, perhaps it's not a fundamental problem, but the other point that could be stressed is that lowering this case, of course, gives you the possibility of having some new observable phenomena as accelerators, as I will also stress in the course of my talk. So I can go quickly through the introduction, because you are all experts on this, the basic of it. The basic building blocks for the construction of any realistic n equal to 1 supersymmetric models are chiral vectors and gravitational supermultiplets. And the role of the gravitational supermultiplet is clear when you discuss the spontaneous supersymmetry breaking by looking, for example, at the scalar potential, which is built from the auxiliary fields associated with these supermultiplets. The auxiliary fields of the matter and gauge fields give positive definite contributions to the potential, whereas the auxiliary fields of the gravitational supermultiplet give a negative definite contribution to the potential. And this is what allows, at least from the kinematical point of view, to have spontaneous breaking of local supersymmetry with sufficiently small cosmological constant. In particular, on Poincaré background, the vacuum expectation value of the auxiliary field of the gravitational supermultiplet has this expression in terms of the gravitino mass and of the Planck mass. Now, what are the generic experimental constraints that we have to obey? The constraints are that the cosmological constant should be vanishing or sufficiently small, the present upper bound being of the order of the weak scale square divided by the Planck scale, and that the scale of supersymmetry breaking must be at least of the order of the weak scale to account for the fact that we haven't seen any supersymmetric partners of the ordinary particles. This means that there must be a quite accurate cancellation between these two contributions. And as a result of this cancellation that is imposed on us by phenomenology, we can put in one-to-one correspondence the supersymmetry breaking scale lambda Susi with the gravitino mass M3/2. So this is why, for all practical purposes, I can use one of the two scales equivalently. Well, this is also telling that it's quite likely that gravitational effects play an important role in the selection of the supersymmetry breaking vacuum, even if this is not a theorem. Now, going ahead with the sort of kinematic aspects of supersymmetry breaking, we don't have to date a convincing dynamical fundamental theory of supersymmetry breaking, so I will be restricting my considerations to these general aspects. Spontaneous supersymmetric breaking occurs via the so-called super Higgs effect, the analogous of the Higgs effect in gauge theories. The Goldstino, which is a linear combination of the spin 1/2 fermions of the theory, chiral supermultiplet fermions and gauginos, weighted by the by the vacuum expectation values of the corresponding auxiliary fields, provides the plus or minus 1/2 ellicities of the massive gravitino. And the supersymmetry breaking mass splittings in the different multiplets of the height sector of the theory are proportional to the supersymmetry breaking scale, or equivalently to the appropriate power of the gravity no mass, via a model-dependent effective coupling constant that gives you the coupling of the Golestino multiplet to the sector of the theory that you are considering. So, even if we stick to the prejudice that in order to solve the hierarchy problem, the supersymmetry breaking mass splittings must be of the order of the electroweak scale, we are still left with the freedom of choosing the supersymmetry breaking scale, or equivalently, the gravitino mass. So, in the absence of a prediction for what the gravitino mass or the supersymmetry breaking scale should be from the fundamental theory, we are allowed to take the gravitino mass as a free parameter to be constrained only by phenomenology and to look at what happens when we vary that fundamental parameter. So doing, we can distinguish three broad options for the gravitino that can be characterized equivalently by the effective coupling of the Golestino multiplet to the remaining fields, or by the gravitino mass, or by the supersymmetry breaking scale. Now, I will describe only the two extreme options, but of course there can be many intermediate cases. The case of the heavy gravitino corresponds to the Golestino having couplings of gravitational strength. In this case, the gravitino mass is of the order of the weak scale, and the supersymmetry breaking scale is some sort of geometrical average between the electroweak scale and the Planck scale. The other extreme option that I'm going to discuss today is the case of, this is the case, for example, of the so-called hidden sector supergravity models, just to give you a reference point. The other extreme case corresponds to the effective Golestino couplings to the standard model fields being of order 1, and correspondingly the gravitino mass being of the order of the weak scale square divided by the Planck scale, and the supersymmetry breaking scale being very close to the weak scale. There are models in between, for example the so-called gauge-mediated or messenger models fall in this intermediate category. Now, there is an important difference in how we should take the low energy limit in which we neglect gravitational interactions suppressed by inverse powers of the Planck mass in the two cases. In the heavy gravitino case, also the Golestino components have interactions of gravitational strength. So the appropriate limit to take is to send the Planck mass to infinity by keeping the gravitino mass fixed. So doing, also the supersymmetry breaking scale goes to infinity. And what we end up at the electroweak scale is a renormalizable theory, the minimal supersymmetric expansion of the standard model, with explicit but soft breaking of supersymmetry of the order of the gravitino mass. And all the other renormalizable interactions are suppressed by inverse power of M Planck and therefore are thrown away from the effective low energy theory. In the case of light and superlight gravitino, whenever the Golestino has interactions that are stronger than the gravitational interactions, we have to take a different low energy limit that corresponds to sending the Planck mass to infinity, keeping fixed the supersymmetry breaking scale, and therefore the gravitino mass goes to zero. In this way, one can neglect consistently all interactions of gravitational strength that are much weaker than the other interactions involved with the supersymmetry breaking, and one ends up at low energy with a theory that has spontaneously broken global supersymmetry with a field contact that contains at least the states of the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model and the multiplets that have non-vanishing projection along the Golestino direction, and in addition one has, for many instances, to take into account all the non-renormalizable interactions that are involved, that are suppressed by scales lower than the Planck scale. In particular, this is made possible by the existence of the so-called Golestino-Gravitino equivalence theorem, which is the counterpart of the ordinary equivalence theorem relating Goldstone bosons with the longitudinal component of massive gauge bosons. And this theorem says that if we work at energies much larger than the gravitino mass, which will be the case, which is the case in all the, these models for most of the phenomenology, what of the full gravitino state, one has to take into account only the Goldstino components, because the interactions of these components in their coupling to the current of supersymmetry receive an enhancement going like the energy divided by the gravitino mass. So one can throw away the transverse gravitino states and work in the low energy effective theory with global supersymmetry and only the Goldstino states. So the general picture of how one can proceed in this context is the following. We have originally some unknown macroscopic theory that describes the dynamics of supersymmetry breaking. Now, if we go to sufficiently low energies, we end up with an effective theory where global supersymmetry is linearly realized, and whose Lagrangian can be characterized, as usual, by a gauge kinetic function, a superpotential W, and a Keeler potential K. Plus, and in some cases they will become relevant, some higher derivative supersymmetric invariants that don't fall into this conventional Keeler description of effective supersymmetric Lagrangian. And the degrees of freedom, as I was saying, are the multiplets of the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, plus at least one multiplet containing the Goldstino states, plus possibly other multiplets that remain light, that we cannot exclude. Now, if we work at energies that are smaller also of the supersymmetry breaking mass splittings, then we can go to a more effective theory, where we integrate out all the superpartners, and we end up as only degrees of freedom with the standard model particles plus the Goldstino. And in this effective theory, supersymmetry is non-linearly realized. Slightly slower than expected, and perhaps I'm saying things that you know very well, so I will try to speed up. Now, what are the most important features of this first step of the effective theory when supersymmetry is still linearly realized? Well, there is one important model-independent feature, and is the fact that the couplings of the Goldstino to supermultiples, particles-particle pairs, are controlled by the universal coupling of the Goldstino to the current of supersymmetry, and by use of the equation of motion, one can rewrite these couplings on shell in such a way that they involve only the supersymmetry breaking scale, I'm calling here it S, you can call it lambda Susi if you want, and the supersymmetry breaking mass splittings in the different multiplets. For example, without knowing anything about the details of the model that breaks supersymmetry, you can still estimate, for example, the decay rate for the lightest MSSM particle into the corresponding particle and the Goldstino. Just to give you a simple example, take the photino, the photon, and the Goldstino. This decay rate depends only because of that relation on the photino mass and on the supersymmetry breaking scale, and can be immediately generalized to a neutralino of arbitrary composition. Similarly, also other interactions involving the Goldstino in this effective theory that in the formalism are controlled by the derivatives of the superpotential, the gauge kinetic function, and the Keeler potential evaluated on the vacuum can be re-expressed in terms of the supersymmetry breaking mass splittings that I'm denoting here generically with delta M and the supersymmetry breaking scale. To give you some other examples, the fermion-sfermion Goldstino coupling is controlled by the supersymmetry breaking sfermion mass, and the same, for example, for four fermion interactions involving two Goldstinos and two fermions. Now, moving to the nonlinear effective theory, where we work at energies smaller than the superpartner masses. Well, first of all, we observe that this is still a realistic possibility for present-day experiments, because no superpartner has been observed yet. And as I was saying before, we go to an effective theory where the only degrees of freedom are the Goldstein and the standard model particles, and supersymmetry is non-linearly realized. One way of obtaining this effective theory is to start from the previous theory and to integrate explicitly the heavy degrees of freedom in the low energy approximation. So doing, we find that the couplings in this effective theory have no residual dependence on the supersymmetry breaking masses, but they depend at leading order in the low energy expansion only on the supersymmetry breaking scale as a result of supersymmetric cancellations. And we can compare what we obtain with this procedure with the standard law on nonlinear realizations of supersymmetry. You can find in textbooks, after the work started by Volkov and Akulov and pursued by many other authors, including Vess and collaborators, that the on-shell scattering amplitudes with two Goldsteinos and matter engaged particles are fully controlled by the supersymmetry breaking scale and by the canonical energy momentum tensor of the matter engaged fields. You can even write them down in a superfield notation. Just you can promote any field, and in particular the Goldsteino, to a superfield just by acting on it with the supersymmetric charges. So you can construct a nonlinear Goldsteino superfield lambda that in the theta component contains the supersymmetry breaking scale, and also a nonlinear superfield for any of the fields of the standard model, and so doing you can write the nonlinear realization of supersymmetry in this superfield notation, where L tilde is the standard model Lagrangian promoted to a superfield, and lambda is this nonlinear Goldsteino superfield. Now you can test the consistency of this procedure on some examples. Well, the first almost trivial example is the four Goldsteino amplitude. And what you obtain by this explicit construction that I have described to you before, after integration of the heavy degrees of freedom, is a nonlinear realization which on shell can be shown to be equivalent to the Volkov-Akulov Lagrangian. A less trivial example is the two-photon, two-Goldsteino coupling. Well, here you have to take into account that the Goldsteino is accompanied, in the simplest case of F-term breaking, by some spin-zero partners that I will call Goldsteinos, and that are a complex, form together a complex scalar. So there are two different contributions to the two-photon, two-Goldsteino amplitude. One involves Goldsteino exchange, with vertices controlled by the Goldsteino masses and by the Photino mass. And another one involves Photino exchange in the T channel and U channel, with vertices controlled by the Photino mass. Now, if you take the low energy limit, so if you work at energies much smaller than the Photino and the Goldsteino masses, you find what you should expect, in fact, that even if the individual amplitudes go like the energy to the third power times the Photino mass divided by the appropriate power of the supersymmetry breaking scale, the overall amplitude doesn't depend any longer on the Photino mass and goes like the energy to the fourth divided by the appropriate power of the supersymmetry breaking scale. So, for example, the cross-section for these processes, these annihilation processes, has an extremely soft behavior at low energy, going like S cube divided by F4, and not as it was originally found. And this is telling us two things, that this is equivalent to the standard nonlinear realization, you can explicitly check, and also it can throw away some phenomenological worry that was coming by considering processes such as supernova cooling or nucleosynthesis. These processes, if they had a larger cross-section at low energy, could play an important role, but they are very strongly suppressed and they are phenomenologically irrelevant. Now, a small surprise comes when you consider the two fermion two Goldstino coupling. For simplicity, I'm discussing here the case of just one single two component massless fermion. In this case, the contributions to the 4-point amplitude come from a contact interaction of the type I've described before, controlled by the fermion mass, and by T and U channel diagrams involving fermion exchange, with vertices controlled again by the fermion mass divided by the supersymmetry breaking scale. Now, the first fact that occurs is that, again, in the low energy limit, the overall amplitude behaves in a softer way and loses any dependence on the supersymmetry breaking masses. This is as expected on all grounds. On the other hand, if you compute explicitly what the effective Lagrangian describing this 4-point amplitude is at low energy, you see that it is the sum of two terms. One term that I have denoted with L1 is precisely what would be prescribed to you by the standard nonlinear realization of supersymmetry. This is on shell equivalent to the coupling of the Goldstino bilinear to the energy momentum tensor of this fermion. On the other hand, you find that there is a second coupling that one can parameterize in this way, and that one founds to correspond in this specific case to a coefficient alpha equal to 4. This new coupling gives contributions, non-trivial contributions to the on-shell scattering amplitudes, and therefore cannot be dismissed. Now, we were puzzled for a while about the interpretation of this new coupling, but at the end the answer was not so difficult to find. The point is that the two Goldstino Lagrangian in the nonlinear realization of n equal to 1 supersymmetry is not completely specified by the supersymmetry breaking scale F. Indeed, you can show that there is a second, and only a second, independent invariant contributing at the same order in the low energy expansion to these types of amplitudes. And this invariant is written here in superfield notation analogous to the one I was writing before, where E is the nonlinear superfield containing the fermion F under consideration. Now, the next question is, how come that by performing the explicit integration you ended up with a specific value of this coefficient alpha? In principle, this should correspond to a free parameter of the underlying theory. And the answer again comes after a little thought. The point is that the original Kähler formulation we started from doesn't include higher derivative operators that carry, for example, that give rise, for example, to four fermion operators with derivatives included. So this coefficient alpha is indeed a residual ambiguity in the effective theory coming from higher derivative supersymmetric operators not included in the Kähler formulation. And if you want a physical analogy, this is similar to the case of forward pion nucleon scattering in chiral Lagrangians, as you can read, for example, in Weinberg's book. If you look at it, there are two contributions. One is fully controlled by Fy. The second one involves also the axial coupling. So I find this a very close analogy. By now, all the two Goldstino effective interactions have been fully classified, and for the point of view of phenomenology, the only particularly important ambiguity in the discussion of interesting physical processes is the one connected with this operator. Now, let me move now, after this theoretical part, to a discussion on the phenomenological constraints that with the available tools we can derive on the hypothesis of a very light gravitino. Now, let me discuss first the phenomenology at colliders, and then I will discuss indirect constraints coming from processes involving only standard model particles. Well, it is clear that if the gravitino is very light, there are new unsuppressed non-renormalizable interactions that become important at energies of the order of the weak scale, and this gives the possibility of new phenomena not accounted for by the standard model, or even by the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. Even the standard pair production of supersymmetric particles in the minimal supersymmetric standard model could be affected in the cross sections and distributions by the exchange of virtual gravitinos and sgolstinos. So this whole chapter should be revised. But also we have a new possibility now in the game, that we can produce directly gravitinos in the final state due to their unsuppressed interactions associated with the Goldstino components. Now, the production of gravitinos can occur with or without other supersymmetric particles, and may become relevant when we push the energy up to the highest available energy now. So, if the available energy is sufficient to produce other supersymmetric particles in association with the gravitino, then we can look at processes in which the gravitino is produced in association with a gluino, or a squark, or a neutralino. And one has to redo all the phenomenological analysis for this type of production processes. And the phenomenological analysis is complicated by the fact that there are dependencies on the details of the spectrum of supersymmetric particles. So I don't want to bore you with this. The other possibility is that the available center of mass energy is not enough to produce other supersymmetric particles besides the gravitino, the case of heavy superpartners. So the gravitino is the only available light supersymmetric state, and you could look in your collider experiments at final states such as gravitino-gravitino photon or gravitino-gravitino jet, where the jet can originate either from a quark or from a gluon. And by making use of the SUSY low energy theorems I've described to you before, you can perform at least in first approximation this analysis with a reduced amount of model dependence, because essentially the most important dependence comes from the supersymmetry breaking scale plus those small ambiguities such as the one that I've just described to you before. So, at colliders, you can look at processes such as C minus going plus to photon plus missing energy, when the missing energy is the one carried away by the gravitinos or goldstinos. This, for example, is relevant for LEP or for a future linear E plus C minus collider. And at hadron colliders, you could look at both at the photon plus missing energy and at the jet plus missing energy signal. At the Tevatron, the most important processes are those involving quark-antiquark annihilation. At the LHC, the most important ones at the partonic level are those involving quark-gluon annihilation. The common feature of all these processes, without giving you too many details, is that the cross-section has a very strong power-like dependence on the energy. They go like S cube divided by F4, where square root of F is the supersymmetry breaking scale, multiplied by a model dependent factor that takes into account the dependence on the fractional photon or jet energy and on the scattering angle. And the important feature of this factor is that universally it has a very strong suppression at large X, so that these cross sections are unfortunately dominated by the soft and collinear part, so they are quite difficult to distinguish from the background, especially at hadron colliders. So in the absence of a signal, one can use these processes to put an absolute lower bound on the gravitino mass or on the supersymmetry breaking scale. And remarkably, both from LEP and from the Tevatron, these lower bounds are not so strong. The present lower bound is of the order of 200 GeV, corresponding to a gravitino mass of the order of 10 to the minus 5 electron volt. Mm-hmm. Well, I have even a figure with the experimental details. In that figure is written that the bound is 220 GeV, but one should take into account that there are uncertainties in these calculations that can easily account for such a variation in the bound. Now, for example, the strongest bound comes from the tevatron, but at the tevatron, but is not as much stronger as the lep bound as one would naively think, because the higher center of mass energy at the tevatron is compensated by the much more severe background problems. Also, at the tevatron, the effective center of mass energies of these collisions is such that our the approximation inherent in the low energy effective theory starts to break down. We start approaching the unitarity limit of our low energy effective theory, and so we shouldn't take it as literally as the second significant digit in this number. Now, notice that this type of analysis, from the phenomenological point of view, is very similar to the one that is done in the models with large extra dimensions where only gravitational fields can propagate. And indeed, these studies, in a sense, follow the scheme of our studies of gravitino perproduction. However, there are some important differences between the production of Kaluza-Klein gravitons that can be produced singly and of gravitinos that must be produced in pair because of our parity. In our case, we have cross sections going like S cube. In the Kaluza-Klein graviton case, you have always a slightly harder behavior with energy, and also you don't have to pay the phase space price that corresponds to three body final states in our case and two body final states in their case. As a result, typically, the bound on the fundamental scale, say it in first approximation, the string scale that characterizes this class of models, are in general significantly stronger than the bounds on the supersymmetric breaking mass scale that we obtain in our case. Now, these bounds obviously will be improved by experimentation at tevatron and the LHC. Now, let me discuss for a moment the indirect constraints that we can have on such an hypothesis, and I will come back also to the objections that Alan was raising at the beginning of the talk. I repeat, a new scale close to the electroweak scale can in general lead to dangerous non-renormalizable operators constructed with the standard model fields. Now, for our point of view of effects of the caused by supersymmetry breaking and parametrized in the effective theory of supersymmetry breaking, the typical situation is that these operators are not calculable within the effective theory, in the sense that we are able to control in the effective theory only the lower derivative operators. In that case, we can use the relations associated with supersymmetry and sometimes relations associated with the gauge symmetry. But some of the observable quantities that matter are associated with the operators that are unconstrained from the point of view of the low energy effective theory, in the sense that they are characterized by arbitrary coefficients, and one can do only dimensional analysis essentially with these operators. Nevertheless, we can still derive some naturalness bounds just by looking at the stability with respect to quantum corrections small coefficients associated with these operators. Let's take, for example, the case of electroweak precision tests. Now, in the standard literature, the electroweak precision observables can be conveniently parametrized in terms of some parameters that are called S, T, and U in the American literature, and epsilon 1, epsilon 2, and epsilon 3 in the European one. They can all be related to consistently to some electroweak observables. In these models of superlight gravitino, these parameters can receive in principle contributions not only from self-energies but also from vertex and box diagrams, so the computation would be quite involved, but one can estimate their size on purely dimensional grounds, and indeed write examples of graphs contributing to these parameters. And the typical scaling law on pure dimensional grounds that one gets is that these epsilon parameters that are constrained by experiment to be of the order of the per mil are, have a loop factor alpha over 16 pi square times a ratio of scales of this form, where mz is the mass of the z boson, delta m square is a supersymmetry breaking mass, and f is the supersymmetry breaking scale. So you can see that even for f very close to the electroweak scale, indeed you generate corrections to these parameters that are within the experimental bounds. And the possibility of cancellations cannot be excluded. For example, you can impose a custodial symmetry conveniently on the underlying theory, for example, and set to zero the contribution to the effective rho parameter. Another thing, another indirect test that one can look at are the four fermion contact interactions. That is one of the usual ways of parametrizing possible deviations from the standard models in collider experiments. Indeed, one can look at even more severely constrained for fermion contact interactions, those associated with baryon and lepton number violation and flavor change in neutral current. These are the big worries in all the models with a low string scale or with a low compactification scale. And there is nothing more to say in this respect in connection with the supersymmetry breaking scale, apart from the fact that these interactions could be suppressed by symmetries of the supersymmetry breaking sector. If the supersymmetry breaking dynamics respects baryon and lepton number or has some flavor symmetry, the same statement will apply to the effective interactions generated by these dynamics at low energy. Now, this argument cannot be carried on for the more usual flavor conserving for fermion interactions that in these models are characterized by a dimensionful coupling constant that cannot be computed in terms of the supersymmetry breaking scale. On the other hand, on these interactions we have quite stringent constraints from experimental data at Tevatron, LEP and HERA. Well, sometimes these constraints are emphasized in size by choosing appropriate units to count the coefficients of this effective interaction, but let's say that in this notation, typically the constraints are of the order of 2 to 5 GeV, which translate into smaller numbers if you use this parametrization. Now, as I said, you cannot compute from the point of view of the effective theory these coefficients, but you can look how stable a small coefficient could be with respect to quantum corrections in your effective theory. For example, you can look at the leading divergences contributing to these operators in the effective theory. Indeed, it's easier to compute them because they have they are quadratic and they have a geometrical interpretation in terms of the Ricci tensor of the Kähler manifold. For example, four fermion operators can be generated by this quadratically divergent loop diagram with the Goldstino exchange, controlled by the supersymmetry breaking scale and by the supersymmetry breaking masses. Well, you have to make a choice for the cutoff. The cutoff could be anywhere between the supersymmetry breaking masses and the unitarity bound of your effective theory. In the worst possible case, you choose it to be the unitarity bound of your effective energy theory, and you obtain a bound on the supersymmetry breaking scale, which is, I stress again, a naturalness bound, and in any case is not much stronger than the bounds I have been previously discussing. So, indirect constraints give you roughly bounds of the same order of magnitude as direct searches, but of course this bound can be interpreted at most as naturalness bounds. Well, I was another sort of bound that we computed in some detail also to understand precisely what you can compute and what you cannot compute in the effective theory, is the bound coming from G minus 2. But now my time is passing, so I don't think I will go through the detailed discussion, because I want to make some other considerations before the end. So let me just show you, for example, the type of one-loop diagrams that contribute to G minus 2 in these models. You have the standard supersymmetric QED loop diagrams, and then you have other loop diagrams that involve the exchange of the photino, the supersymmetric partners of the muon, the smuons, and the supersymmetric partners of the Goldstino, the Sgolstinos. And most, but not all, of these diagrams are characterized by the supersymmetry breaking spectrum and the supersymmetry breaking scale. Unfortunately, if you write down the most general effective theory that you can write, there are some coefficients associated with some interactions that cannot be put in one-to-one correspondence with the spectrum. So again, and indeed precisely with these coefficients are associated some divergent contributions to G minus 2, where all the other diagrams give finite contributions controlled by the supersymmetry breaking spectrum. So again, you can give at most the interpretation of a naturalness bound, and you can interpret the result by the fact that you can write a higher derivative supersymmetric operator that contributes to G minus 2 once supersymmetry is broken, and which is not included in the standard Kähler formulation. If you use these finite contributions to G minus 2 to put a naturalness bound on the the supersymmetry breaking scale and the supersymmetry breaking masses, you get a generic behavior that is of this form, where m mu is the muon mass that breaks the chiral symmetry protecting G minus 2, and mx is a typical combination of supersymmetry breaking masses that you can explicitly derive in the case of finite contributions. Indeed, you can impose some symmetries that suppress sufficiently the divergent contribution so that your result becomes calculable, but this is not the generic situation. So again, the bottom line is that with the present bounds on G minus 2, we get no significant constraint stronger than the direct collider constraints. Some more interesting constraints will be derived once the Brookhaven experiment of G minus 2 will reduce the experimental error by a factor of 20. MX is a combination of supersymmetry breaking masses, so the smuon masses, M1 and M2, the Gaugino mass, and the Sgolstino masses, and an off-diagonal smuon mass. So
you saying the effective Lorentz theory, which is renormalizable?
No, no, this is a non-renormalizable theory. It's a non-renormalizable theory.
This theory is what?
The cutoff of this theory, as I said, is somewhere between, you cannot specify it exactly if you don't know what the underlying microscopic theory is, but it's reasonable to expect that it is somewhere between the scale of the supersymmetry breaking masses and the unitarity bound of your, the three-level unitarity bound of your effective theory. Now, under some symmetry assumptions that are not the general case, indeed the contribution to G minus 2 is finite in this theory and is controlled only by the supersymmetry breaking masses and by the supersymmetry breaking scale at the one loop level. But this is not the generic situation, because in general terms you can write a counter term. So you shouldn't, the message is that you shouldn't interpret too strictly this bound, even if it gives you an order of magnitude bound on the mass scale involved. Now, in the last, do I have 5 more minutes? In the last 5 minutes, well, I will give you my conclusions and I will comment on one small point that I would like to bring to your attention. So, the the message that I wanted to transmit with this talk is that the possibility of very light gravitino is still an open theoretical option that should be put to experimental test together with the other more conventional hypothesis of a light gravitino and of a heavy gravitino. Now, if you are an optimist, with doing this you have one more chance to discover supersymmetry. But even conservatively, you should realize that the gravitino mass or the supersymmetry breaking scale is for supersymmetry models perhaps the most important fundamental constant. It plays for supersymmetry breaking the same role that the Fermi constant plays for electroweak symmetry breaking. So, irrespectively of all other considerations, it's, at least in my opinion, important to set model-independent bounds on this fundamental constant. Now, there are still some open theoretical issues in this business. For example, it's not so easy as you may think to write down the general effective theory that would describe simultaneously SU2 cross C1 and supersymmetry breaking, both of them in a spontaneous way. And in a sense, these difficulties are the counterpart of the difficulties that people working in gauge-mediated models and so on encounter in reproducing the so-called mu parameter and b-mu parameters that are essential in the description of the Higgs sector. On the other hand, with some patience, this could be done, and it can be interesting because, with, of course, some free parameters, it can give a phenomenology of the Higgs and Higgs sector which can differ significantly from the phenomenology of the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, and perhaps can allow a more general treatment of electroweak precision tests than the one I've given to you roughly before. Also, another point I would like to stress is that if you lower the supersymmetry breaking scale, bringing it very close to the SU2 cross U1 breaking scale, then you don't have really strong reasons to assume that the Goldstino is a singlet under the SU2 cross U1 gauge group. And you should take this fact into account. In a similar way, there may be a possible mixing between the supersymmetric partners of the Goldstino, the Goldstinos, and the Higgs bosons of the model. So one would need to generalize this description to account for this possibility. One extreme possibility that I would like to show you as a curiosity, but without putting excessive emphasis on it, is the fact that you could even think of not enlarging the number of states in the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model, identifying the Goldstino with some of the states that are already present in the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. So you can ask the question, can I describe spontaneous supersymmetry breaking using only the MSSM states without introducing extra singlets, but just by making use of arbitrary non-renormalizable interactions that I can introduce in a supersymmetric way? Well, you can see that in the absence of Fayet-Lyapunov terms, you can immediately in one line prove a theorem that if the superpotential, the gauge kinetic function and the Keller potential are non-singular at the origin, then you have always a vacuum with unbroken SUSY for obvious reason that to construct gauge invariants you need at least bilinears. Now, one way out of this, just to have a toy model to play with, is to introduce some singularity at the origin in the model. For example, the simplest thing you can think of is to write a superpotential with a square root type of singularity involving the gauge invariant analytic combination of the Higgs fields, and to keep a regular gauge kinetic function and Keller potential. Now, for phenomenological convenience, I take a Keller potential of this form that doesn't depend on all possible invariants, just to have a custodial symmetry that guarantees me rho equal to 1 in the model. Now, if you do this, Indeed, you can build a model that has supersymmetry and SU2 cross U1 both spontaneously broken. The vacuum expectation values of the Higgs field are equal. Rho is equal to 1 and is protected by a custodial symmetry. And the Goldstino is identified with the symmetric combination of Higgsinos. Another important feature of the model is that due to the presence of non-renormalizable interactions that with very little suppression, the usual prediction of the minimum supersymmetric excitation of the standard model of having a light Higgs disappears. Now, it's not clear if this toy model can be promoted to a fully realistic model. And the point is that there are some conflicting requirements that you have to impose that don't allow you to perform precise calculations in this model. The fact is that on the one hand, you want the supersymmetry breaking masses to be at least of the order of the weak scale to account for the non-observation of supersymmetric particles. On the other hand, there are non-renormalizable interactions in the model that are require to preserve three-level unitarity that the supersymmetry breaking masses not be much larger than the supersymmetry breaking scale, for obvious reasons, and also that the supersymmetry breaking scale be not much larger than the weak scale, because there are new non-renormalizable interactions generated by the singular behavior of the superpotential. So, I don't know if this is a possibility. I don't know how it can be rigorously ruled out, because there are intrinsic calculational limitations that affect the possibility of making calculations in this model. Maybe one can think of going to some partially non-linearization, integrating out the heavy fields associated with the stronger couplings.
This the problem with that potential not single valued, I mean, is that any problem with the...
I mean, you...
I mean, you
no, you, in a sense, you, it's sufficient that your superpotential is well-defined in a neighborhood of the vacuum of your theory, and this is the case. I mean, you don't want a global validity of your theory in the model, in the field space, especially taking into account that you are working in an effective theory. So I think from that point of view, one would be reasonably happy with well-behaved functions in a sufficiently large area around the vacuum. Okay, let me come back to the conclusions. Well, I stressed to you that there may be surprises in this game connected with the possibility of a non-singlet Goldstino. And I should also say that there are some still unsatisfactory points with this possibility of superlight gravitino. Perhaps the most unsatisfactory is the difficulty in constructing microscopic models that give that lead to this possibility. It's clear that this any microscopic model must involve some strongly interacting dynamics at a scale very close to the electroweak scale. So this is also the reason why it is difficult to build an explicit model of this sort. One cannot think of mimicking what happens in the so-called gauge-mediated models, because there, supersymmetry breaking is communicated by perturbative interactions, so automatically you have a perturbative loop suppression in the supersymmetry breaking masses with respect to the supersymmetry breaking scale, and therefore you fit the experimental bound on the supersymmetry breaking masses by asking, by hand in a sense, that the supersymmetry breaking scale be sufficiently above the electroweak scale. To reproduce this type of effective theory, you would need to go to a radically different type of model. And I don't know, perhaps, if a situation of this kind can be realized by bringing the string scale very close to the electroweak scale. This is an open question. Okay, so I think I can stop here.
You might have beginning, but in the large dimension scenario, yes, does one have the same range of gravitational things that look like hidden sectors and things that look like the ones you use?
Well, it depends in a sense how supersymmetry is broken. You have different possibilities for supersymmetry breaking. It could be broken in the bulk and not on the brains. It could be broken on our brain. It could be broken on a distant brain. And I guess that the closest thing, this type of scenario would be reproduced
on our
brain. Yeah. In all the other cases, indeed, you are trying to reproduce in some way a suppression of the effective breaking in the standard model states with respect to the fundamental supersymmetry breaking scale.
What happens in that extreme example you showed?
Well, it would require a detailed investigation that we didn't have the courage to do yet. In a sense, you have the same limitations as exploring the phenomenology of the heavy Higgs in the standard model when the heavy Higgs the Higgs mass gets close to the unitarity bound. You can do calculations, but you don't know how much you should trust the outcome of
it. If you could do a controlled speculation, you find the phenomenology interesting.
Yes, that's. One could use this, as a paradigm for something radically different from standard supersymmetry, even if it cannot be justified on a completely rigorous basis. The calculation has intrinsic limitations. So it may be worth, as an exercise, to work out in detail the phenomenology of the Higgs sector in this case. It could be.
Yeah.
You cannot rule. I don't know how to rule it out.
I'm sorry to read your paper. It's very, very interesting, and I've looked at very early in the line.
Because you have new contributions to the Higgs, new contributions to the Higgs masses that come from the non-renormalizable interactions, and that since these non-renormalizable interactions are
unsafe, this
space that you do would be S3 mod dn, right? Because it's points at unit distance from
the dn singularity. No, but in this framework you see them at the tree level, just in addition to the mass terms and to the quartic coupling that you have in the MSSM, you have also higher dimensional couplings in general that are not suppressed and therefore could modify significantly your mass.
And beta is 6, right?
Just, I can build also with tan beta different from 1, but in that case I don't know how to impose a custodial symmetry.
Tan beta is not really the issue, because Higgs mass is not related to tan beta, so...
All the scalar masses are related... the diagonal terms in the scalar masses are related to the curvature of the Keller manifold, as you can prove. So it's sufficient to have a sufficiently curved Keller manifold to give the scalars the masses you want. Now, in models with large scales, the curvature is bound by the ratio of the electroweak scale over this large scale, so you cannot do it. But as an absolute statement, supersymmetry doesn't imply a light Higgs boson. Supersymmetry plus renormalizability or plus the assumption of some desert. It's very close to what happens in the standard model. I mean, if you assume that you can extrapolate the standard model up to sufficiently high scales above the electrovis scale, you get an upper bound on the Higgs mass. If you release that assumption, you lose it. Let me just put down.
But there's two ways to think about it. First of all, if you want out V1, then it flows to a Lavinberg, as you said. But if I just take in this case, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, in the five brain case, N is a three sphere with torsion on it, and it flows to a big sphere instead of a small sphere. I mean, maybe that's not what I'm supposed to think about. Right, the five brain is this cross a three sphere with torsion.
That's right.
And so it doesn't flow to zero radius like we talk about later, it flows to actually some finite non-zero radius.
It's not really flowing into zero radius, it's a bit more involved because it flows into R goes to minus infinity.
Right.
Well, you actually lose the geometric value.
Right.
So
the best way
to think about it is really that it flows into the Lambda Green's law.
That
model,
yes.
Which is the minimal model,
yes.
Times the sphere. But there is this ZK twist that you were talking about, which makes it equivalent to
Yes, the thing that you do later makes sense. This sentence, I think it's not as simple as this.
That is right. We put the sentence in a very misleading, simplified way because it's just an imprecise way to say in one sentence what is explained later. And that's the most important part of this sentence for clarifying this movement.
Okay, yes.
So what we really mean by this sentence is what we explain later.
Good. Okay, that makes sense. What you explained later seems all to work. I've never thought hard about chiral rings and things, but it does seem like you have a lot of agreement. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I just have to read this paper now. You keep citing it.
There are some relations with things in there. There they have typically Ramondamon.
Yes.
But even with Ramondamon, they could. And they consider maybe the theoretical interpretation of people.
I was just going to be able to get out of the way.